Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Oh. Well, welcome. Glad to have you here. This is David Francis from the Texas Institute for Measurement, Evaluation, and Statistics, and I'm here with Mabel Rivera, who worked with me on the development of these documents that you've been sent. And what we want to do is to sort of walk you, we're not going to walk you through them literally, but rather to give you an overview of what's in them and how we think you would start working with these documents, what they're intended to accomplish and what they're not intended to accomplish. The work was supported as part of our work on the, at the Center on Instruction, the English Language Learner Strand. And I guess I'll ask, does everyone also have a copy of the PowerPoint?
Yes.
Okay. Since I'm not actually controlling what you're seeing, I'll tell you, if you have them up, I'll tell you as I move to new slides. Right now I'm on the second slide and just sort of going over where the support came from. And so I'm on the second slide. So this was supported as part of our work at the Center on Instruction, the English Language Learner Strand, and that's, you know, one of the comprehensive centers. Directed by RMC Research and TIME, the Texas Institute for Measurement, Evaluation, and Statistics at the University of Houston, is responsible for the English Language Learner Strand. And Mabel Rivera works with me in that strand, and I'm the director of it. These documents were produced with the help of Noni Lasseau, who is, and I'm on slide, the next slide now, Noni Lasseau, who is a faculty member at Harvard in the Graduate School of Education there, and Michael Kiefer, who is a graduate student who works with Noni on a variety of research topics related to English language learners, Mabel and myself, and Hector Rivera, who was previously here at the University of Houston. He's now currently at Southern Methodist University. He took a tenure-track faculty position at Southern Methodist in the fall. And going to the next slide. So there are three books that individually, book one talks about recommendations for instruction and academic interventions. Book two discusses recommendations for serving adolescent newcomers. And book three talks about accommodations in large-scale assessments, and I'll actually talk about each of these books in just a few minutes. In order to give you a sense of what's the purpose of this presentation is really to give you an orientation to the books and not so much to go through them point by point and highlight and identify all of the specific recommendations. We're confident that you can read the books and that that they'll make sense. That they're not written for researchers, but rather for practitioners and administrators. We are developing PowerPoint presentations for actually working more directly with the books that will go out to the regional centers for working with your constituencies. So this particular PowerPoint is really just kind of an overview PowerPoint, and we're developing more specific professional development around each of the particular books that has that have speaker notes in them and things like that. So those will be forthcoming, but they're not ready for distribution just yet. So in working with the books, you'll see that there is some redundancy across the books, and the reason for that is that when we started on this process, we originally intended for it to be a single document with three sections in it, and it became clear that that wasn't going to work. We originally envisioned a single document that was going to be about 50 pages long. And when we got to a manuscript length of 170-some pages, we knew that it wasn't going to work, and we were going to have to break it up into multiple documents, which is what the department wanted us to do anyway. So we ended up with three separate documents, but there are certain elements that we feel are really critical to each part. And so as you read them, you'll see that there's this redundancy in the foreword and in the overview, talking about language and the importance of language and academic language and the background with respect to English language learners. So you'll see some redundancy, and we ask you to just sort of bear that in mind, that we didn't want to write three separate introductions. So what you have is just some replication of information. And then I feel that it's necessary to explain some conventions that we use in producing the books. In particular, we used both footnotes and endnotes, and this was a point of confusion for some readers, so I feel it's necessary to point out the difference between them and what we intended by them. The footnotes are things that we feel need immediate clarification or might need immediate clarification as you're reading, and so we wanted that information on the same page where you encountered the possible information that needed to be clarified. So rather than place that somewhere in an appendix or at the back, we wanted it right there where you could have immediate access to it. The endnotes, on the other hand, are for those references and sort of elaborations on the reference material that help to clarify what research we're looking at in reaching a particular conclusion, and provide you with some additional details about the reference material. So anything that's sort of an elaboration of a point that requires immediate clarification, we try to put that in the footnotes, and anything that deals with the broader picture and is something that is more reference material, we placed in endnotes. And each document has its own set of references as well as the information that's in the endnotes. And anything referred to in the endnotes, the full citation for it will appear in the references. Okay? So as you're looking at the endnotes, you should be able to, any reference that you see in the endnotes, you should find the full reference for it in the references section. Okay, so I just make that distinction for you so that it should make working with the documents a little bit easier. Okay. Going to the next slide, key reference materials, I want to point out that we did not engage in a separate review of the research. That was not our intent. Our intent was to take some work that had already been done, completed within the last few years, and try to take that information and make it more accessible for people who are not researchers. And in particular, we drew heavily on the recently completed report of the National Literacy Panel for Language Minority Children and Youth. That's August and Shanahan of 2006. That's an edited volume. I participated in that National Literacy Panel and wrote the chapter on language of instruction. Dr. Lasseau also participated in the National Literacy Panel and worked with me on the chapter on language of instruction, as well as the chapter on literacy development, and one other chapter, and I'm blocking on which one it was. But so she was contributed to that volume as well. And then there was a second review done by Genesee, Lindholm, Leary, Saunders, and Christian, which also came out in 2006. That was done by Creed. And both of those really provide an excellent overview of the research on literacy, instruction, and intervention. And we pulled in some additional reference material that might not have been referenced there, but we drew heavily from those two sources. In the book on newcomers, we again relied on work in August and Shanahan that focused on adolescent newcomers, adolescent students rather. We also looked at the Genesee et al. Reference for work in adolescents, and then we relied heavily on a new volume by Debbie Short and her co-author, whose first name I'm blocking on, Grace, you probably know it, Boyson. This is a document published by the Center for Applied Linguistics. And it is actually an update of a previous volume on newcomer programs. And we relied heavily on the work that Dr. Short had done in reviewing newcomer programs. And I'll talk more about what we found there. And then in the area of accommodations, we relied on several recent reviews, one by Abetti, Hofstetter, and Lord, a product by Steve Cerisi, Lee, and Carpati that came out in 2003. And both of those are generalized, sort of general reviews of the accommodations literature. Although the Cerisi doesn't provide a lot on English language learners, it does have some information. But then we also looked at an edited volume by Charlene Rivera and her colleagues, Collum and Schaefer-Wilner, and that was also published in 2006. And that is a book that reviews state policies, and it is an excellent volume for you. I highly recommend all of the books and articles here on this sort of primary reference or key reference list, but especially I think the book by Rivera and her colleagues, the book by Short and Boyson, and the review of the National Literacy Panel. All three of those are key documents for you, and you should make sure that you have them on your shelf. So going on to the next slide, we'll go ahead and sort of get into the presentation. We have literally an hour, right? So you know, the English language learners are a unique group as defined under No Child Left Behind, insofar as membership in this group is not intended to be static. It is the only group where it's intended that your membership is temporary, and that as you become proficient, you will no longer be a member of this group. And when we look at the English language learners, they face a really unique set of challenges as learners in our schools. They have to develop content-related knowledge and skills related to their state academic standards, and at the same time, they have to acquire the language in which those standards are and the knowledge that's associated with those standards are being taught. And in the case of young children, this may be taking place or will be taking place at a time when their first language is not fully developed. And it is one thing to try to develop another language when you have a fully developed L1, and it is another thing entirely to try to develop a second language while you're also developing the first language. And, of course, then they are going to need to try to demonstrate what they've learned in that second language on language assessments. Sometimes those assessments might be in their first language, but often they're in the second language, and generally that's going to depend on what the language of instruction is. So they really, as a group, present a unique set of challenges to everyone in the educational enterprise, both to teachers, to administrators. They present unique challenges for our assessment systems and also for our accountability systems. So I would ask you to jump now to the slide that says at the top, academic language is a key organizing principle. It's like two slides from the last one.
You know, I'm sorry to interrupt, David. This is Pam Spiescher from WestEd. I didn't get the PowerPoint. I was scouring my email. Where is that available?
It's available on the COI website.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. Right. So if you can access the website, you should be able to pull it down.
Okay.
Is it easier for people if I tell you numbers of slides?
No.
This is slide number 9.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. If you can't get it, let me know, and I can send it out on
okay.
an email.
Okay, thanks.
So one of the key organizing themes across all of the books, all three books, is the critical importance of academic language. And here we reference the work by Robin Scarsella, and you can get the exact reference out of the books, but it is also, I think, a key reference for individuals serving schools and states were dealing with English language learners. You want to get a look at her chapter on academic language. The development of academic language, I think, is arguably the most fundamental thing that students who are English language learners have to learn to be successful on content area assessments. I would actually argue, and I don't think I'm in the minority here in saying this, that it is actually a key fundamental principle or fundamental skill that needs to be acquired by all students and not just our English language learners, and it's an often neglected component of instruction. And that is that a lot of our low-income students and minority students who are not English language learners also do not have adequate development of their academic language to enable them to be successful on content area assessments. And so it is crucial to academic success in all domains. It's not just about reading language arts. It's crucial for success in science, for success in social studies, and even for success in mathematics. And there's no question that it's the primary source of difficulties for English language learners. It can remain a challenge for students even after they have lost their designation of being a limited English proficient student. And it affects, there's no question that it affects the performance of students on large-scale assessments. And I'm doing some work right now for the department looking at some assessments and the relationship between language proficiency assessments and the content area assessments. And I can tell you that, I mean, right now I've just looked at one state, but certainly in that state the relationship is really quite strong, both for reading, language arts, and for mathematics. The relationship between performance on the language assessment and performance on the content area assessment is quite powerful. So we'll go to the next slide, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about academic language because it is such an important concept, and it is so critical, really, to students' overall success, and it really permeates what needs to be accomplished, both in terms of instruction and intervention, in terms of newcomer programs, and in terms of when we think about accommodations. We're going to constantly be coming back to this idea of academic language. So this is a key organizing principle that runs throughout the three books. One of the first things to keep in mind in thinking about academic language is that we are not talking about conversational English skills, that it is quite possible to have adequate conversational skills, even good skills in terms of conversational English, but lack the academic language that you need to be successful in content area instruction and on content area assessments. And one of the things that we see frequently in studies is that the vocabulary scores for English language learners in those studies are frequently, on average, below the 20th percentile. And it is very difficult for students to be able to master the content in a domain of knowledge above the third or fourth grade when language skills are extremely low. And so, you know, it's no question that students can be conversant and able to hold a conversation with their teacher, with their parents, with people on the street, but not have the academic language that they need to be able to master the content in their textbooks, to be able to reason and to write with conviction, and to be able to perform well on academic assessments. So it's academic. I'll go to the next slide, which is slide 11. Academic language is comprised of many skills, certainly vocabulary knowledge, and when we talk about vocabulary knowledge, we're talking both about depth of knowledge as well as breadth of knowledge. And by depth, we mean, of course, knowing lots of meanings for any given word, whereas for breadth, we mean knowing many words to represent different ideas, including words that are different to reflect on subtle differences between in meanings. And so students need to have both breadth and depth in their vocabulary, and it needs to be vocabulary around academic concepts. We talk, I don't believe I have this in the PowerPoint, but we do talk in the books about the academic word list, which is actually a website that you can go to, which has a list of critical vocabulary words in each of a variety of content areas. And we have the reference for the website in the books, and I highly recommend this to you. It's called the Academic Word List. Also within academic language, we make distinction between written vocabulary and oral vocabulary. The vocabulary used in text is quite different from the vocabulary used in most oral conversation and speech, and so it's not sufficient for students to be able to understand information presented to them orally. They also have to have good text-based or reading vocabularies. They need to be able to understand complex sentence structures and complex syntax, and they need to understand the logic and structure of argument, both for academic discourse and for working in expository text. A lot of times we see students getting a lot of exposure to narrative text without much help and instruction in how to work and navigate through expository text. So going to the next slide, number 12, this is just a sort of a general organizational slide. When you look at each book, you'll find that they're laid out in roughly the same way. There's a foreword, followed by an overview. That overview includes a description of the population and some general statements about the organization of the book that you're looking at and the general methods that are used. And then following that overview section of the document, there'll be the section on recommendations for, and it will depend on the book. We'll have maybe multiple sections of this type. For example, the interventions book, instruction interventions book, has sections on reading and mathematics. And within each of those sections, then, where we talk about recommendations, you'll find a conceptual framework presented. Our goal in writing these books was to really give teachers, administrators, school personnel, people working with those people, a framework for how to think about instruction and intervention for English language learners, how to think about accommodations, how to think about newcomers and the things that newcomers need. And so it's really, if we accomplish that objective, that is how to give you a conceptual framework for thinking about and making decisions, then we'll have accomplished our goal. So we don't in these books get down into nitty-gritty, this is what you need to do on day one of instruction, and this is what you do on day two, and this is what you do on day 180. It's very much trying to give you a broad strokes framework or overview for how to think about English language learners. And then we provide some specific recommendations. Okay. And within these sections, we would also have any, if there were specific methods that we followed for that section that weren't generally applicable to the entire document, then they would be presented in this sort of recommendation section. So, in general, we put the methods up in the overview part, but sometimes it was necessary to embed it in the specific section because it was only relevant to that particular section. So let me, I'm going to skip over this part about who are English language learners, because I think you, given your roles in the regional centers, you know this information, and certainly you can read it, so it's not really critical to understanding the books. With possibly one exception, and that is that I want to point out that, as I mentioned, English language learners struggle with academic language. And it's often the case that English language learners continue to struggle with academic language even after they have lost their designation as being limited English proficient. Now, while it's true that some English language learners in some states have actually started doing reports that disaggregate data by number of years in school and by whether or not children have achieved language proficiency. And those reports, and we cite actually reports from both Texas and New York on this point, while those show that many English language learners actually do quite well in school once they have acquired proficiency in English, it's still the case that there are many students in that group that are struggling, and it's really those kids that we have in mind, both those kids who are still acquiring English and those kids who, even though they have reached the level of fluent English proficient on their state language assessment, continue to struggle with academic concepts because their language development is still behind. It's those kids that we're really focused on in these books, and not that group of English language learners who become fluent English proficient and then do just fine in school, of which there are more than a handful, but there are still many students who struggle. So I want to jump now to, just in the interest of time, we'll jump down to book number one, and let me see, I'm on slide 16. And so in looking at book one, it's organized in the way that I said in terms of the general overview, but then we have separate sections in with regards to reading and mathematics. in writing this particular book, we drew, as I said, extensively on the work of August and Shanahan the authors of the chapters in the National Literacy Panel report, on the short volume by Genesee and his collaborators, as well as a report on mathematics by the National Research Council and a report on mathematics by the RAND Corporation. And we also drew on work from the National Reading Panel, which was published by NICHD back in 2000. And so I want to talk for just a second about that. When we look at the research on English language learners, we find, and this was, a key finding of the National Literacy Panel report, that is the August and Shanahan volume, is that when we look at the developmental research with English language learners, we find that the process of literacy acquisition for English language learners and English-only students is really very similar. They go through the same stages, they require the same instruction in the same kind of core areas, and the process is very, very similar to acquiring proficiency. And what that means is that the developmental process is similar. That doesn't mean, and it doesn't imply, it shouldn't be taken to imply that English language learners and English-only students are going to traverse that process at the same rate. It also doesn't mean that the English language learners are going to encounter the same kind or the same level of difficulty as non-English language learners. It doesn't imply that. It just implies that the process is similar, the components that drive the process are similar, and that means that there's much that we can learn from the literature that focuses on English-only students. There's much that we can generalize from that literature in terms of important components of instruction for English language learners. So in writing this document, we reviewed, as I said, these documents that focused on research with English language learners, but we also took into account research that focused on mixed samples of English language learners and English native English speakers, where the data might not have been disaggregated. And then we also looked at studies that dealt with, or we drew on what we know from the literature on English-only students, that is, native English speakers, where it was justifiable to generalize from that literature back to the English language learners on the basis of those elements of the process that are quite similar. So that's a little bit different from many of the other reviews or guidance documents in that they're often restricted to what's been shown specifically with English language learners. And because of what we've seen in the reviews that identify points of consistency in the developmental process, we feel that there are things that can be learned from the research literature on English native English speakers as well. And where we felt it was justified, we drew on that information as well. So going to the next slide, slide 18, we know that reading is fundamental to the development of content area knowledge and academic success. This is a statement that applies to all learners, not just English language learners. And in thinking about this fundamental importance of reading to academic development, we distinguish three different kinds of functions for instruction. Instruction can be, its general purpose could be to try to augment the performance of all students in the classroom. That is, that it's targeted at the whole class and boosting and building the skills of everyone in the class. It can have a primarily preventative function, meaning identifying kids or children who are likely to have, who are at risk for the development of problems, and trying to provide them with preemptive instruction that will keep problems from emerging. Or it can be remedial in nature, and that is that a problem has emerged and we're trying to address it. And we try to distinguish instruction for these different kinds of purposes within the volume, and talk about each of these three purposes, not just in terms of the instruction, but also in terms of assessment and things like that. So there's no question that to be effective, educators have to have a clear understanding of the specific kinds of challenges and problems that a particular learner or group of learners is going to face. And that implies that there has to be assessment and connection of assessment back to instruction. And we talk some about that in the book. As I've said several times, English language learners often lack the academic language that they need to be able to comprehend and analyze complex texts. This becomes more apparent as children encounter more and more complex texts in the middle and upper grades. And so, but it's not an issue that we can wait until the middle or upper grades to start to address. We really have to start addressing children's academic language development in kindergarten before any content area assessment is taking place. Academic language development should start in the very beginning of school, and it should be something that is ubiquitous across the curriculum, and that is that teachers that are teaching in the content areas need to think about what their language objectives are in terms of what language children need to know to be able to be successful in this content area. And this is a theme that is very consistent and is a major component, I would say, of the Sheltered Instruction Observation Protocol, or the SIOP model, which Debbie Short and Jana Echevarria have developed. And it is also, I think, the driving force behind the Title III provisions for states to try to align their language proficiency standards with their academic content standards. The whole idea there is what is the language that children need to know and have mastery of to be able to be successful in content area assessments. And it is all about the academic language needs of students and what they need to be successful on content area assessments or in developing content area knowledge, which is just demonstrated by the assessment. So when we look at literacy development, we see that the areas where English language learners tend to struggle is really with respect to fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension. And that's not to say that there are no English language learners who struggle at the more basic elements of development of phonemic awareness and phonological awareness. But the incidence rates of problems of that type in the English language learner population are actually quite consistent with the incident rates of those problems in the native English speaker population. So the development of the early literacy skills, phonemic awareness, phonological awareness, simple decoding skills, the incidence rate of problems there is actually quite similar to what we would expect in the native English speaker population. But even when children develop those skills, English language learners may still struggle with fluency, they struggle with vocabulary, and with comprehension. And it's important to realize that these are mutually interdependent skills. Fluency is not simply the ability to perform decoding skills in a rapid and automatized way. It's not driven entirely by the phonics system. It is also dependent on comprehension and vocabulary. When you're reading text that's comprised of words that you know and where you know the meanings of those words, you will be more fluent in reading it because you're anticipating what's coming next. Your knowledge of those words is more automatic. As you encounter more words that you don't know the meanings of, your processes slow down and you become less fluent. And as a consequence, you put more demands on your memory system and other, on your working memory for processing the text and keeping in your mind what it is that you're reading about and what it means. And so when we see children who are disfluent in reading connected text, we have to consider how much of this disfluency is because of problems in learning the code, how much of the problem is driven by lack of development of vocabulary, and how much of it is that they're not understanding what it is that they're reading, which may be partly due to fluency problems and or vocabulary problems. Okay, so we try to make that point very explicit in this in the book about how fluency, vocabulary, and comprehension work together. We point out that English language learners need early, explicit, and intensive instruction in the development of phonological skills and phonological awareness, but that these skills are very highly correlated across languages. Evidence is that these skills in some alphabetic languages correlate over 0.9. And we've looked at research published in Korean and also between Spanish and English, and phonological abilities in those in Spanish and English correlate over 0.9, and the same is true in English and Korean. And this is a really critical point insofar as when children have developed these skills in one language, they don't need to redevelop those skills from scratch in a second language. There's much that they have that they can draw on. They will need to learn the sounds of that new language. They'll need to learn the relationship of the sounds to how those sounds are represented in print. But they will already have some meta-knowledge of how this works, and it turns out that children who are good at it in one language will tend to be good at it in another language, will require less instruction when trying to acquire this in a second language. Children who struggled in their first language will struggle with it more in the second language. The other key point around instruction and intervention is that students need a lot more opportunity to engage in development of sophisticated vocabulary. They need more opportunities to interact around language and academic discourse. And students who are English language learners also need explicit instruction in comprehension strategies, that is, how to work with text, especially text that might have in it many words that they don't know the meanings of. So how will they navigate that text as they're also trying to acquire the vocabulary that they need to work with it? And so typically that translates into specific instruction and comprehension strategies. And the same kind of instruction in terms of the kinds of strategies and also how to teach those strategies. There's no evidence that you need a different process of instructing in those strategies for English language learners than the way that they're taught for native English speakers, although you may have to accommodate the language challenges that students face. But it's not a different learning process. When we think about trying to promote children's fluency, we have to think about increasing their vocabulary development as well as increasing their exposure to print and giving students opportunities to read and read out loud. And when we think about giving kids opportunities to engage in independent reading can be successful for English language learners, but you have to do more than just giving students a book and tell them, go read on your own for a while. In order for independent reading to be beneficial, it first and foremost has to be structured, and it has to be purposeful, meaning you have to describe for the student what it is you want them to do. You want them to engage in this reading for a specific purpose and for a specific amount of time. And it helps to provide them with questions that they're intended to read to derive answers for. So the key point there is it's not just a matter of sitting down with a book, but rather sitting down with that book for a purpose. The second thing is that there has to be a good match between the reader and the text that they're working with. It's not beneficial to ask the student to read independently and then assign them a book that is well above their reading level or well below their reading level. The book needs to be targeted at their reading level so that they can work with the text in their, what Vygotsky used to refer to, the zone of proximal development. It needs to be challenging, but not so challenging as to be frustrating and stressful. It's not helpful if it's too easy because there's not much learning that takes place. So we want to try to target the reader and the text. And there are systems for doing that. There are a number of different systems. One that I'm most familiar with is the Lexile system. It's possible to assign, determine a student's Lexile level, and then many books are Lexiled so that you can match students to text. And then there are other systems as well. When we get to, if you go to the next slide, this is slide number 23. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten to tell you when I'm jumping from slide to slide. But I'm on slide 23 now. When we get to the area of mathematics, there's just a lot less information that we can glean from the research. The mathematics instruction and intervention, especially for English language learners, are just much less researched than literacy. And certainly literacy for English language learners is much less researched than literacy for native English speakers. So the first thing that we have to keep in mind is that we just have a lot less empirical evidence to go on. But we can say that academic language is still of central importance to performance in mathematics. And we go through in the book and provide specific examples about aspects of language that students may struggle with that would be important in terms of their, development of mathematical concepts. And as I mentioned to you, I'm doing these analyses now where I'm looking at relationships between language assessments and content area assessments, and even in mathematics, the correlation between the language assessment and the mathematics assessment across grades ranges from 0.4 to 0.65, something like that. So it's quite strong in terms of the link between language and performance on the math assessment. The kinds of problems that English language learners tend to have with mathematics are very similar to the kinds of problems that native English speakers have, and so they need the same kinds of instruction to prevent problems. They need early, explicit, and intensive instruction in math concepts, building math skill, building fluency with math facts. These are all critical aspects of mathematics development that all children need, and English language learners are not different in that regard. They also need to have academic language development developed so that they can solve complex word problems and understanding how things are related when they're confronted with a word problem. They also need that academic language in order to be able to understand operations and things that are complex concepts that are being presented by the instructor. So I'm going to jump now to the next slide, and we'll talk about the book on adolescent newcomers. And here we drew heavily on the work by Debbie Short and her colleague, Dr. Boyson. And we also drew on the chapters from August and Shanahan dealing with adolescent students. And we know that adolescent newcomers are going to struggle with language and language acquisition. They are going to vary quite a bit. I guess I also want to point out a recent development or a recent publication also by Debbie Short that she developed through the Carnegie Foundation. And this, hang on just a second. The title of the report is called Double the Work: Challenges and Solutions to Acquiring Language and Academic Literacy for Adolescent English Language Learners. And we couldn't reference this work because it wasn't yet released. It was just released early November, and it is available from the Alliance for Excellent Education. Grace, is it also available from Cal?
No, sorry.
Okay, so only the Alliance. So, but you can get it from the Alliance, and the title, again, is Double the Work. And it was an effort led by Debbie Short and Shannon Fitzsimmons. And so I recommend that to you as well. So I'm going to go to the next slide. We know that that newcomers need support in development of comprehension. We know that they need intensive instruction in learning to write for academic purposes. When we when we think about newcomer programs, we're going to, in the book, we talk about sort of instructional elements, and then we talk about organizational elements. And I have to say that, as I mentioned, we draw heavily on the work from Debbie here in terms of what is recommended, but it's also the case that there is not a lot of empirical research out there to be able to say that that if you take this approach, this is the effect that you will get. So the recommendations about effective practice are based on more on the, I guess, on face validity and on sort of case study type evidence about programs that appear to be effective and well organized, as opposed to rigorous experimental research that has tested the impact for different kinds of organizational principles or different kinds of instructional principles. So when we look at the instructional principles, we're not necessarily, in terms of the literature, we're not necessarily looking at instructional principles in newcomer programs, but rather what has been effective with adolescent students. And then could that be applied, or how might that be applied in newcomer programs? And where we have information from newcomer programs, we draw on that information, but often that is not empirical in nature. Rather, it is more case study and anecdotal information. So that's why we refer to these books as practical guidelines. One of the key elements that we see in developing effective instruction for newcomers is that is having effective assessment programs, so that students are evaluated both in their first language as well as in English to understand their strengths and weaknesses, both with respect to what they know and are able to do in their first language, as well as what they know and are able to do in English. And with adolescent newcomers, we see the greatest range of variability in terms of abilities, both within L1 as well as within English. And the reasons for this are obvious, that students are older, but they also have very diverse backgrounds with respect to their education in their first language and in their home country. And so we have some students coming in who are quite accomplished in the education system in their home country, and what they need is to quickly acquire the language that will allow them to be successful in English language instruction and in U.S. schools. Other students may have limited or no instruction or education in their formal education from their home country. And so these are students who may be in the sixth or seventh grade, but without any formal education up to that time. And so these students face a very different set of challenges, and the schools that are trying to instruct them a different set of challenges than those who come in already proficient, know how to read in a language, and need now to learn how to read in a second language and to develop just that language. So it's important to keep this variability in mind, and I actually would say that the Double the Workbook does a really nice job of talking about these differences and also providing some numbers in terms of a breakdown of the kinds of students that schools face. We know that when we look at students who are having word reading difficulties, they're going to need specific explicit intervention, and it's going to need to be intensive. If students are struggling with word reading difficulties, and that is very similar to what we see with adolescents who are native English speakers and still struggle with word reading difficulties. But it's also fair to say that the adolescents more often struggle with fluency, comprehension, and vocabulary than with word reading difficulties, although they certainly struggle with word reading difficulties as well. In terms of organizational elements, so I'd have you jump down to the next slide, 27. Again, there's very little empirical research on what organizational elements work. When we look at those programs that report being successful, and we find that they have strong support for assessment of student needs, and for placement of students, so they'll have a variety of programs within their newcomer program, or a variety of approaches to instruction, and students will be placed on the basis of the assessments that have been given, depending on their strength of prior academic development, their strength of English development, their strength of the language development in their first language. Many programs use heterogeneous grouping that allows students to develop language more quickly because they're working with students whose language skills are potentially more advanced than theirs, as well as working with students whose language skills are less advanced than their own. This can be beneficial to students as they work to develop language. Many of the programs offer extended instructional time, so we'll have high school programs that run for 5 or 6 years, instructional programs that involve extended day. They may run on weekends. They may run through the summer so that students are actually in instruction 12 months out of the year. So it takes into account the fact that for adolescents, there is oftentimes more to be learned and less time in which to learn it before students will be out of the system. And so we have to increase the intensity of instruction by giving extended time, both in terms of during the day and across the course of the year and possibly for additional years. And so that's a key element of programs, is how do they manage the time variable. There's often what we see is strong coordination between different components of the program. So programs that focus explicitly on the newcomers, and then programs that sort of take the newcomers as they have begun to develop skill, and then program and then move them into the mainstream classroom. And so the three different kinds of instruction that the students might get are very well coordinated across the programs. And then finally, these programs target resources both for language and for literacy instruction. They find ways to maximize the available resources that they have, and we provide some examples in the book about how they do that. So I'm going to go on now to the third book, which deals with accommodations, and I'll just sort of give you an overview of this book. The first section of the book deals with state policies that are used across the country. We did a review of websites, but we relied very heavily on the more extensive research that has been done by Dr. Rivera and her colleagues on state policies. It's an outstanding volume that I highly recommend to you. Then after reviewing state policies and trying to provide you with a framework for thinking about state policies and which policies are the kinds of policies that states should be endorsing, we actually conducted a meta-analytic review of the published research on the use of accommodations in large-scale assessments. And so a large section of this book is actually new research that is the meta-analytic research on accommodations. Okay. So the second slide here just cites the primary references that were used in compiling this book. And let me give you a just sort of a general overview of what you'll find inside the book. It's important to realize that assessments of content knowledge are influenced by students' language proficiency. There's really no getting around that. The only possible exception to that is when you have a purely computational math facts type of assessment, but that is not generally what students encounter in school, and so it's kind of a trivial example. And as soon as you get to word problem solving in mathematics, anything in science and social studies, and then certainly reading language arts, language is fundamental to students' performance on content area assessments. And being able to disambiguate what's a language problem from what's a knowledge problem, and where is it where language and knowledge can't even be separated because they're so tightly linked. That is a real challenge for test developers as well as for people thinking about accommodations and how to when to provide accommodations for students. So, but what is clearly the case is that when we think about developing appropriate accommodations for English language learners, appropriate accommodations are going to address the linguistic needs of the student. And it is the language needs of the student that are interfering with their ability to demonstrate what it is that they know. And so the question is, how do we accommodate the language needs of the student? And when we deal with appropriate accommodations for students, we'll see that they address the student's linguistic needs. When we look across the board, though, at the state policies, I believe in the Rivera volume, there are over 70 accommodations that they find in use in states. Well less than half of those would be considered appropriate accommodations in the sense that they address the student's linguistic needs. More often than not, the accommodations seem to be better pitched towards students with disabilities, or they seem to be developed, I should say, out of a disability framework rather than out of a framework that thinks in terms of what are the specific needs of this particular group of learners. And so when we look at policies, we want to think in terms of, do they address the linguistic needs of the students? Go to the next slide, which is slide 32. We provide there a list of specific accommodations that have been discussed in the literature and or in the that are in use by states. The accommodations that are listed on this slide with asterisks are all ones that have been studied in the empirical literature and are the ones that we're going to talk about in the review or meta-analytic review of the accommodations research. And so as you go through, you'll see that these deal with things like providing extended time, giving students breaks, using the use of dictionaries, either bilingual dictionaries or English language dictionaries, providing modifications to the test that involve simplifying the language of the test, and on occasion providing native language assessments. And we'll have more. I'll have more to say about that. I don't want to get into it just yet. Allowing students to respond and take the test in one language, but respond in their first language. These are a variety of accommodations that all are responsive to the needs of English language learners. But when we think about accommodations, we have to ask ourselves about those accommodations in terms of three specific criteria. And we really do think of them in terms of these three criteria in this order. And that is the accommodation effective? Is the accommodation valid? Is it practical? And it doesn't make any sense to ask the practicality question if the accommodation is not effective or valid. We don't have to worry about the validity question if the accommodation is not effective. So we would prioritize the questions effectiveness first, validity second, and practicality third. And by effectiveness, we mean if we assign this accommodation to English language learners and to will English language learners who get the accommodation perform better on the test than English language learners who do not get the accommodation? Okay. So the first question that we have to ask is, does it make a difference in student performance? That is, does it make a difference in the performance of the English language learners when they receive or don't receive the accommodation? The second question, validity, is it really gets at whether or not the accommodation alters the construct validity of the assessment. Generally speaking, in the literature, this is addressed by asking if non-English language learners are given this accommodation, do non-English language learners who get the accommodation do better on the assessment than non-English language learners who do not get the accommodation? If the accommodation alters the performance of non-English language learners, that calls into question the validity of the accommodation. In essence, we have somehow changed what it is that's being measured because now it's benefiting non-English language learners as well. So clearly it is not an accommodation that addresses the needs of the English language learner alone. So it would not be appropriate to give such an accommodation only to English language learners if it benefits all students. Okay. And then finally,
even if an accommodation is effective and valid, it may be impractical in the field in terms of how to do it. And so sometimes things like pop-up dictionaries that are computerized are not practical if a state doesn't use a computerized assessment. So in looking at the accommodations literature, there are 11 experimental studies out there, and these are studies where students were randomly assigned, English language learners and non-English language learners were randomly assigned to either receive the accommodation or not receive the accommodation. All of these studies used random assignment to conditions. The studies involved 37 different samples of students. That is, that we're going to get 37 different measures of effect size in terms of differences between English language learners and getting the accommodations and English language learners not getting the accommodations. And so the meta-analysis reports on these 37 different tests of effectiveness of the accommodations. If you go to slide 35, you see a breakdown of the description of the studies in terms of the populations that they dealt with. And what you immediately notice is that many of the accommodation studies deal with fourth and eighth graders, very few with any other grades. We have two studies each for fifth and sixth graders, nothing for seventh graders, nothing for third graders, nothing for high school students. Now, that doesn't mean that there are no studies out there, but there were no experimental studies, and there really actually aren't that many other studies. So it pretty much means that there aren't any high school studies. In terms of the subject area covered, 17 of the studies dealt with math, 19 dealt with science, and only one dealt with reading language arts. And 22 of the studies dealt with NAEP items, and another 6 dealt with sort of a combination of NAEP and TIMSS. And then only 9 of the effect sizes, I should say, dealt with state accountability assessments. And those state accountability assessments actually came from two different states only. I think it was, I know it was Delaware, and I think the other one was Minnesota. So none of the other published experimental studies dealt with state tests from the other 48 states. So, in summary, it's a fairly limited set of studies in terms of, A, the kinds of accommodations that are being studied, the kinds of students that are being looked at in terms of their grades, the content areas being looked at, and certainly the type of outcome assessment. And in particular, where we're most concerned, which is on state tests, very little information about how these accommodations might work on state tests. So the types of accommodations studied, if you'll go to slide 36, type of accommodation studied, we have 15 effect sizes dealing with simplified English and another 11 that dealt with English dictionaries or glossaries. So there's a fair amount of information about simplified English and also English language dictionaries. A bit less on bilingual dictionaries, only 5 studies, and only 2 with extended time, 2 with Spanish language assessments, and then 1 each looking at dual language questions or dual language booklets. Now, some of the studies actually bundled accommodations and used extra time along with, say, dictionaries. So we have other studies that involve extra time, but we focused on the primary accommodation here. So if it was English dictionaries with extended time, the study is coded under dictionaries. But we also looked separately at the extent to which we could separate out those effects. So if you go to the next slide, slide 37, you'll see a table of effect sizes. Average effect sizes across these different areas. This is there are 2 slides here, 37 and 38, which provide an overall summary of the results of the meta-analysis. And I need to draw your attention to something that you need to correct. Do you have if you have a hard copy of the book, you need to correct it. And if you have a PDF copy that was downloaded after October 30th, you don't need to worry about this. So I'm going to give you an error in the table. It's correct in the PowerPoint, and it's incorrect in the book. And this is table 2 in the book, and it's on page, I think it's page 21, but I'm not positive. I'm sorry, it's on page 31. It was off by 10. If you have a hard copy of the book and look at page 31, the very last line where it says overall mean, in the book it reports that the overall average effect size was a negative 0.034. It's actually a positive 0.034. Okay? So that should be a positive 0.034. It's the very last line of table 2 on page 31. It's corrected in the PDF if you downloaded the PDF after October 30th. So the important information in this table is to actually look first in this sort of column of average effect sizes, and then to look over at the p-value, which is about the, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the seventh column over. And what you see is that there's only one accommodation which has a positive average effect size that is statistically different from zero. Okay, and that is English dictionaries and glossaries, of which there were 11 studies. The average effect size for simplified English is positive 0.020, and that is not statistically different from zero. Spanish language assessments had a negative average effect size that was statistically significant, but there was also evidence that the effects were heterogeneous across the two studies. And I think that in terms of the bilingual accommodations and the native language assessments, there's a whole lot more work that needs to be done there, because it's not clear in the studies how well students were matched in terms of the language of instruction with the language of assessment and the accommodation. And so it stands to reason that if students are not proficient in their first language, or they haven't learned to read in their first language, that giving them a native language assessment is not going to be beneficial. And so it's really not very surprising that we find heterogeneity in the effect sizes for the bilingual assessments. And those were the only accommodations where the variability across the collection of effect sizes indicated that the effect sizes were not consistent across that collection. So, for example, looking at the English dictionary, we see the average effect is 0.146, and the p-value for that is 0.001. And when we look at the heterogeneity in the effect sizes across the 11 studies, we find that it's not statistically significant, meaning that we can conclude on the basis of this test, or we could tentatively conclude, that the studies are finding similar effects. And you contrast that with the 5 bilingual dictionary studies where the average effect size is negative 0.096. The p-value is non-significant, but there's a positive, the variance test, the Q statistic, indicates that the variability across the collection of studies is sufficient to indicate that not all effect sizes are the same in this collection of studies. So something about the differences in the studies is responsible for differences in the effect sizes. Okay? So sort of looking at this table, we would conclude that there is heterogeneity in the effect sizes across the collection of studies. We see that from the Q statistic on the last line of the table, that the overall average effect size for all studies is not statistically different from zero, but that there are some accommodations, in particular English language dictionaries, which appear to have a positive average effect. The second table, the next table, which is on slide 38, simply computes the average under a different model. This second model sort of takes into account the fact that effect sizes might be different across the different studies. And so it is what's called a random effects model, and the results of the previous slide indicate that this is probably the table that we should focus on because of the heterogeneity. And when we look at this slide, we see that the effect for English language dictionaries is positive, and it's slightly larger than it was in the other table, around 0.178. The conclusions about the other accommodations are not significantly different, although the Spanish version accommodation no longer has a significant negative effect size. And in fact, the effect size is now positive, but it's not different from zero. So the heterogeneity and the differences in the studies are really impacting the average effect size for the Spanish version test, and it's because there are so few studies there. Okay, so we really don't have much that we can say about them. So if we sort of summarizing across the group of studies, and I'm going now to slide 39. Of the seven different types of accommodations that have been studied in this literature, it's really only the English language dictionaries and glossaries that tended to produce an average effect that was different from zero. There wasn't any indication that this effect varied across study conditions, so it seems as though this would be a good accommodation to focus efforts on. The findings for native language, again, now going to the next slide, slide 40, the findings for native language tests and bilingual glossaries are mixed. There is evidence that these effects differ across the sets of studies. But it also has to be said that we really have too few studies to say much conclusively about what the important factors are. But I think some things just sort of jump out at us, like matching the language of assessment with the language of instruction and making sure that students are actually proficient in their first, that they're literate in their first language if we're going to test them in that first language. And then going now to slide 41. One of the surprises, I think, of the summary for us was the results for simplified English. I expected this accommodation to do better, and I was surprised by the average being as small as it was, and also that it was not statistically different from zero. Adding to that, that the test of heterogeneity was not rejected. And so what that tells me is that simply adjusting the linguistic demands of the test are not going to be sufficient to allow large numbers of English language learners to improve their performance on the test. That may well be because students aren't getting the content area instruction that they need to get. In other words, you've got to teach students the content in order for students to be successful on content area assessments. And simply adjusting the language to make the assessment more accessible may not be sufficient to improve their performance. I think that going to the next slide, slide 42, for an accommodation to be successful in a testing situation, students have to have experience with it in instruction. It's not enough. You can't give the student the accommodation for the first time in the testing situation and expect that it will be very helpful. So if students haven't used dictionaries in the classroom, giving them a dictionary on the test is not going to be very helpful. If they haven't used bilingual dictionaries in the classroom, giving them a bilingual dictionary is not going to help them to do well on the test. We have to focus on alignment of curriculum, instruction, and assessment. That alignment is critical for the development of all students, and it's especially crucial for the development of English language learners. It's pretty clear from at least the research that we have to date that accommodations alone are not going to enable English language learners to be successful on content area instruction assessments. We're going to have to also look at how we're teaching students. I do think it's important to keep in mind that, and I'm now on the last slide, it's important to keep in mind that the lack of results here for simplified English is not necessarily an indictment of simplified English, nor is it an indictment of universal design of assessments. Excuse me, that is still a good principle for designing tests, but it is clear that simply simplifying the English is not going to have a tremendous impact on students' performance. It's also important to keep in mind that the research base here is fairly limited. We only have studies of seven accommodations. no one accommodation. I mean, the largest number of studies or effect sizes was 15 for simplified English. That's not inconsequential, but it's also not a huge database to draw on, especially when we consider the kinds of students that were involved. We only have mostly fourth and eighth graders, and we have very few studies in terms of reading language arts, and even, you know, and very few studies involving state accountability assessments. Most of the studies involve NAEP-like assessments, and so we know very little about how accommodations will or will not affect performance of students on state accountability tests. And that is that's the end. People have any questions? It may be hard to do this on the phone.
This is Cindy Aguilar from New England and New York. I have a suggestion for questions. I know there are lots, people might have questions as they go through the documents. Maybe we could just send questions, post them somewhere, and then you could have responses for us. Would that be a good idea?
That would work out just fine for me, and you can send them to the Center on Instruction ELL Strand email, and they will come directly to me and to Ma Bell.
All
and
right.
we can assemble them and answer them and then post them in a FAQ on the COI website.
That'd be great.
Sure. And that way you could go ahead and you could kind of take the PowerPoint, read the material, and then bring your questions up that way.
I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I tried to go to the website and get the PowerPoint, the COI website, and I can't locate it. Can you be a little bit more specific to where it's located?
I can try. I didn't post it, so let me see if I can.
I know
if
where
I
it
can.
Is. This is
oh, okay,
Kate
great.
At the Texas Comprehensive Center. It's right on the home page under announcements. You go to the very last link in that box. That will take you to the ELL strand. It says grades K through 12 at the top, research. And under number one, it says research-based recommendations for instruction and academic interventions. And right underneath that, it says PowerPoint presentation from LEP partnership meeting.
Is it the one dated October 28th, 29th?
Yes, that's it.
Yeah, we have an update. We'll send out an update. It just has one additional slide in it, the one that talks about the drawing on the English-only research in addition to the research on English language learners. So we will send that to RMC, and they will post it. And I'm sure it'll get posted fairly shortly. Did I hear Ruth on the call from RMC? I thought I heard Ruth Dover on the call. All right, we'll make sure that the new one gets posted. So those of you who downloaded, if you want to download a new copy, you can. And for those that don't have it, you might want to go ahead and download the one that I send them today. Okay?
This is Cindy again from New England and New York. I'll be doing a webcast with my FEAs up here. And am I free to use some of the slides that you've created already?
I believe so.
Okay.
I think what RMC asks is that you just indicate that the slides come from the Center on Instruction presentation.
Absolutely.
But I certainly am more than happy with if you want to use these slides.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sure.
I have another question. This is Barb Youngren from Great Lakes East. Do you have a time frame for the PowerPoints that you're developing for the regional centers?
Well, I have drafts of them, but I'm not sure what our I have to go back and look. Maybe Ma Bell knows. Do you know what the time is for?
Hi, Barb.
Hi.
Right now we are in the first draft of a set of modules based on the book, strictly from the book,
mm-hmm.
That you could probably use to teach actually, you know, the contents of the book. However, we are in plans of adding other sets, but we will include more in-depth discussion of the conceptual frameworks on each of the books.
Yeah.
And also on practical guidelines, you know, for, like, practitioners.
Right.
But I think our time frame for the first
first pass is before the end of this year. So
right.
I think that by December sometime.
Okay, that so was great. And then how will we get those? Will they be posted to the COI site?
They will definitely go to the COI site.
Okay,
yep.
Great. Thank you.
Yep.
And this is Constanza Hazelwood from Great Lakes East. Do you have other conferences scheduled before the end of the year?
We were not planning on doing this conference again. At some point, once the materials, the modules are ready, we need to do some kind of presentation to you about the modules and their use. And so we will certainly be scheduling something around that, but we don't have that scheduled yet.
Okay.
So we're not just going to dump them out there and expect you to pick them up and work with them. I mean, we think you could, but we thought we'd do a sort of an intro to them as well.
That would be great.
That would be very helpful.
Yeah, I don't remember how many of those we said we would do, but I do know that we plan to do some professional development for the centers in terms of how to work with these professional development documents. I mean, it's probably not really PD for you so much as it's just an intro to RPD.
Okay.
Anything else? Well, if not, we will wish you a happy Thanksgiving and enjoy your lunch today, and we will look forward to working with you more in the future.
Thank you
very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.